Tell me something, Richard. Are you superstitious?
Me? You ask an old wop like me if I'm superstitious?
Growing up in a family where my mother and grandmother and all my aunts went around Hail Marying and praying to every saint you ever heard of, and another bunch you didn't ever hear of, and covering up the mirrors when someone died, and poking the sign of the evil eye at crows and black cats that crossed their path? Me? You ask me a question like that?
Yeah, Billy said, smiling a little in spite of himself. I ask you a question like that.
Richard Ginelli's voice came back flat, hard, and totally devoid of humor.
I believe in only two things, William. Guns and money. That's what I believe in. And you can quote me. Superstitious? Not me, Paisan. You are thinking of some other Dago.
That's good, Billy said, and his own smile widened. It was the first real smile to sit on his face in almost a month, and it felt good. It felt damned good. That evening, just after Heidi had come in, Penchley called.
Your gypsies have led us on a merry chase, he said. You've piled up damn near $10,000 in charges already, Bill. Time to drop it?
Tell me what you've got first, Billy said. His hands were sweating. Penchley began to speak in his dry, elder statesman voice.
The gypsy band had first gone to Greenough, a Connecticut city about 30 miles north of Milford. A week after they had been rousted from Greenough, they turned up at Pawtucket, near Providence, Rhode Island. After Pawtucket, Attleboro, Massachusetts. In Attleboro, one of them had been arrested for disturbing the peace and then had jumped his piddling bail. What seems to have happened is this, Penchley said. There was a town fellow, sort of a bully, who lost $10 playing quarters on the wheel of chance. Told the operator it was rigged and that he would get even. 2 days later, he spotted the gypsy coming out of a night owl store. There were words between them, and then there was a fight in the parking lot. There were a couple of witnesses from out of town who say the town fellow provoked the fight. There were a couple more from in town who claimed the gypsy started it. Anyway, it was the gypsy who got arrested. When he jumped bail, the local cops were delighted, saved them the cost of a court case, and got the gypsies out of town.
That's usually how it works, isn't it? Billy asked. His face was suddenly hot and burning. He was somehow quite sure that the man who had been arrested in Attleboro was the same young man who had been juggling the bowling pins on the Fairview Town Common.
Yes, pretty much, Penchley agreed. The gypsies know the scoop. Once the fellow is gone, the local cops are happy. There's no APB, no manhunt. It's like getting a fleck of dirt in your eye. That fleck of dirt is all one can think about. Then the eye waters and washes it out. And once it's gone and the pain stops, one doesn't care where that fleck of dirt went, does one?
A fleck of dirt, Billy said. Is that what he was?
To the Attleboro police, that's exactly what he was. Do you want the rest of this now, Bill? Or shall we moralize on the plight of various minority groups for a bit first?
Give me the rest, please.
The gypsies stopped again in Lincoln, Mass. They lasted just about 3 days before getting the boot.
The same group every time, you're sure?
Yes, always the same vehicles. There's a list here with registrations, mostly Texas and Delaware tags. You want the list?
Eventually. Not now. Go on.
There wasn't much more. The gypsies had shown up in Revere, just north of Boston, had stayed 10 days, and moved on of their own accord. 4 days in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and then they had simply dropped out of sight.
We can pick up their scent again if you want, Penchley said. We're less than a week behind now. There are 3 first-class investigators from Barton Detective Services on this, and they think the gypsies are almost certainly somewhere in Maine by now. They've paralleled I-95 all the way up the coast from Connecticut. Hell, all the way up the coast from at least the Carolinas, from what the Greeley men were able to find of their back trail. It's almost like a circus tour. They'll probably work the southern Maine tourist areas like Ogunquit and Kennebunkport, work their way up to Booth Bay Harbor and finish in Bar Harbor. Then, when the tourist season starts to run out, they'll head back down to Florida, the Texas Gulf Coast, for the winter.
Is there an old man with them? Billy asked. He was gripping the phone very tightly.
About 80, with a horrible nose condition, sore, cancer, something like that. A sound of riffling papers that seemed to go on forever. Then,
Tadeusz Lemke, Penchley said calmly. The father of the woman you struck with your car, yes, he's with them.
Father, Halleck barked. That's impossible. Kirk, the woman was old, around 70, 75.
Tadeusz Lemke is 106.
For several moments, Billy found it impossible to speak at all. His lips moved, but that was all. He looked like a man kissing a ghost. Then he managed to repeat,
"That's impossible."
"An age we all could certainly envy," Kirk Pensley said, "but not at all impossible. There are records on all of these people, you know. They're not wandering around Eastern Europe in caravans anymore, although I imagine some of the older ones, like this fellow Lemke, wish they were. I've got pics for you. Social security numbers, fingerprints if you want them. Lemke has variously claimed his age to be 106, 108, and 120. I choose to believe 106 because it jibes with the social security information that Barton operatives were able to obtain. Susanna Lemke was his daughter, all right, no doubt at all about that. And for whatever it's worth, he's listed as president of the Tadeusz Company on the various gaming permits they've had to obtain, which means he's the head of the tribe or the band or whatever they call themselves.
His daughter? Lemke's daughter?
In Billy's mind, it seemed to change everything. Suppose someone had struck Linda. Suppose it had been Linda run down in the street like a mongrel dog.
It down?
Huh? He tried to bring his mind back to Kirk Pinchley.
I said, are you sure you don't want us to close this down? It's costing you, Bill.
Please ask them to push on a little further, Billy said. I'll call you in 4 days, no, three, and find out if you located them.
You don't need to do that, Pinchley said. If, when, the Barton people locate them, you'll be the first to know.
I won't be here, Halleck said slowly.
Oh.
Pinchley's voice was carefully noncommittal.
Where do you expect to be?
Traveling, Halleck said, and hung up shortly afterward. He sat perfectly still, his mind confused whirl, his fingers, his very thin fingers, drumming uneasily on the edge of his desk. Heidi went out the next day, just after 10, to do some shopping. She did not look in on Billy to tell him where she was going or when she would be back. That old and amiable habit was no more. Billy sat in his study watching the Olds back down the driveway to the street. For just a moment, Heidi's head turned, and their eyes seemed to meet. His, confused and scared, hers, dumbly accusing.
"You've made me send our daughter away. You won't get the professional help you need. Our friends are starting to talk. You seem to want someone to co-pilot you over into ha-ha land, and I'm elected.
Well, fuck you, Billy Halleck. Leave me alone. Burn if you want to, but you've got no right to ask me to join you in the pot."
Just an illusion, of course. She couldn't see him far back in the shadows. Just an illusion. But it hurt. After the Olds had disappeared down the street, Billy ran a piece of paper into his Olivetti and wrote, "Dear Heidi," at the top. It was the only part of the letter that came easily. He wrote it one painful sentence at a time, always thinking in the back of his mind that she would come back in while he was pecking it out. But she did not. He finally pulled the note from the typewriter and read it over. "Dear Heidi, by the time you read this, I'll be gone. I don't know exactly where and I don't know exactly for how long, but I hope that when I come back, all of this will be over. The nightmare we've been living with. Heidi, Michael Houston is wrong, wrong about everything. Lita Rossington really did tell me that the old gypsy, his name is Tadeusz Lemke, by the way, touched Carrie. And she really did tell me that Carrie's skin was plating. And Duncan Hopley really was covered with pimples. It was more horrible than you can imagine. Houston refuses to allow himself any serious examination of the chain of logic I've presented in defense of my belief, and he certainly refused to combine that chain of logic with the inexplicability of what's happening to me. 155 this morning, almost 100 pounds now. He cannot do these things. It would knock him out entirely of his orbit if he did. He would rather see me committed for the rest of my life than to even seriously entertain the possibility that all of this is happening as a result of a gypsy's curse. The idea that such off-the-wall things as gypsy curses exist at all, anywhere in the world, but especially in Fairview, Connecticut, is anathema to everything Michael Houston has ever believed in. His gods come out of bottles, not out of the air. But I believe that somewhere deep inside of yourself, you may believe it's possible. I think part of your anger at me this week has been my insistence on believing what your own heart knows to be true. Accuse me of playing amateur shrink if you want, but I've reasoned it like this. To believe in the curse is to believe that only one of us is being punished for something in which we both played a part. I'm talking about guilt avoidance on your part. And God knows, Heidi, in the craven and cowardly part of my soul, I feel that if I'm going through this hellish decline, you should be going through one also. Misery loves company. And I guess we've all got a streak of 100% gold-plated bastard in our natures, tangled up so tightly with the good part of us that we can never get free of it. There's another side of me, though, and that other part loves you, Heidi, and would never wish the slightest harm to come to you. That better part of me also has an intellectual, logical side, and that's why I've left. I need to find that gypsy, Heidi. I need to find Tadeusz Lemke and tell him what I've worked out over the last 6 months or so. It's easy to blame, easy to want revenge. But when you look at things closely, you start to see that every event is locked onto every other event, that sometimes things happen just because they happen. None of us like to think that's so, because then we can never strike out at someone to ease the pain. We have to find another way. And none of the other ways are so simple or so satisfying. I want to tell him that there was no evil intent. I want to ask him if he'll reverse what he's done, always assuming it's in his power to do so. But what I want to do more than anything else, I find, is to simply apologize. For me, for you, for all of Fairview. I know a lot more about gypsies than I used to, you see. I guess you could say that my eyes have been opened. And I think it's only fair to tell you one more thing, Heidi. If he can reverse it, if I find I have a future to look forward to after all, I will not spend that future in Fairview. I find I've had a bellyful of Andy's Pub, Lantern Drive, the country club, the whole dirty, hypocritical town. If I do have that future, I hope you and Linda will come along to some other cleaner place and share it with me. If you won't or can't, I'll go anyway. If Lemke won't or can't do anything to help me, I will at least feel that I've done all that I could. Then I can come home and will happily check into the Glassman Clinic if that's what you still want. I encourage you to show this letter to Mike Houston if you want to, or the Glassman doctors. I think they'll all agree that what I'm doing may be very good therapy. After all, they'll reason, if he's doing this to himself as a punishment. They keep talking about psychological anorexia nervosa, apparently believing that if you feel guilty enough, you can speed up your metabolism until it's burning umpty-umpty calories a day. Facing Lemke may provide exactly the sort of expiation he needs. Or they'll reason there are two other possibilities. One, that Lemke will laugh and say he never cast a curse in his life, thereby shattering the psychological fulcrum my obsession is balanced on. Or it may occur to them that Lemke will recognize the possibility of profit, lie, and agree that he cursed me, and then charge me for some trumpery cure. But they'll think a trumpery cure for a trumpery curse might be totally effective. I've engaged detectives through Kirk Pinchley and have determined that the gypsies have been heading steadily north up Interstate 95. I hope to track them down in Maine. If something definitive happens, I will let you know soonest. In the meantime, I'll try not to try you. But believe I love you with all my heart. Yours, Billy. He put the letter in an envelope with Heidi's name scrawled across the front and propped it against the Lazy Susan on the kitchen table. Then he called a cab to take him to the Hertz office in Westport. He stood out on the steps waiting for the cab to come, still hoping inside that Heidi would come first and they could talk about the things in the note. It wasn't until the cab had swung into the driveway and Billy was in the back seat that he admitted to himself that talking to Heidi at this point maybe wasn't such a good idea. Being able to talk to Heidi was part of the past, part of the time when he had been living in Fat City, in more ways than one, and without even knowing it. That was the past. If there was any future, it was up the turnpike, somewhere in Maine, and he ought to get chasing after it before he melted away to nothing. He stopped that night in Providence. He called the office, got the answering service, and left a message for Kirk Pinchley. Would he please send all available photographs of the gypsies and all available particulars on their vehicles, including license plate numbers and VIN numbers, to the Sheraton Hotel in South Portland, Maine? The service read the message back correctly, a minor miracle in Billy's opinion, and he turned in. The drive from Fairview to Providence was less than 150 miles, but he found himself exhausted. He slept dreamlessly for the first time in weeks. He discovered the following morning that there were no scales in the motel bathroom. Thank God, Billy Halleck thought, for small favors. He dressed quickly, stopping only once, as he was tying his shoes, perfectly amazed to hear himself whistling. He was headed up the interstate again by 8:30. And was checked into a Sheraton across from a huge shopping mall by 6:30. A message from Pinchley was waiting for him. Information on its way, but difficult. May take a day or two. Great, Billy thought. 2 pounds a day, Kirk, what the hell? 3 days and I could lose the equivalent of a six-pack of tall boys. 5 days and I could lose a medium-sized bag of flour. Take your time, fella, why not? The South Portland Sheraton was round, and Billy's room was shaped like a pie wedge. His overtaxed mind, which had so far dealt with everything, found it somehow almost impossible to deal with a bedroom that came to a point. He was road-tired and headachy. The restaurant, he thought, was more than he could face, especially if it came to a point. He ordered up from room service instead. He had just stepped out of the shower when the waiter's knock came. He donned the robe, which the management had thoughtfully provided. "Thou shalt not steal," said a little card sticking out of the robe's pocket, and crossed the room, calling out, "Just a second." Halleck opened the door, and was greeted for the first time with the unpleasant realization of how circus freaks must feel. The waiter was a boy of no more than 19, scruffy-haired and hollow-cheeked, as if in imitation of the British punk rockers. No prize himself. He glanced at Billy with the vacant disinterest of a fellow who sees hundreds of men in hotel robes each shift. The disinterest would clear a little when he looked down at the bill to see how much the tip was, but that was all. Then the waiter's eyes widened in a look of startlement which was almost horror. It was only for a moment. Then the look of disinterest was back again. But Billy had seen it. Horror. It was almost horror. And the expression of startlement was still there. Hidden, but still there. Billy thought he could see it now because another element had been added. Fascination. The two of them were frozen for a moment, locked together in the uncomfortable and unwanted partnership of gawker and gawky. Billy thought dizzily of Duncan Hopley, sitting in his pleasant home on Ribbon Maker Lane with all the lights off. "Well, bring it in," he said harshly, breaking the moment with too much force. "You going to stand out there all night?" No, sir, the room service waiter said. "I'm sorry." Hot blood filled his face, and Billy felt pity for him. He wasn't a punk rocker, not some sinister juvenile delinquent who had come to the circus to see the living crocodiles. He was only a college kid with a summer job who had been surprised by a haggard man who might or might not have some sort of disease.
The old guy cursed me in more ways than one, Billy thought.
It wasn't this kid's fault that Billy Halleck, late of Fairview, Connecticut, had lost enough weight to almost qualify for freak status. He tipped him an extra dollar and got rid of him as quickly as possible. Then he went into the bathroom and looked at himself, slowly spreading his robe open, the archetypal flasher practicing in the privacy of his own room. He had belted the robe loosely to begin with, and it had left most of his chest and some of his belly exposed. It was easy enough to understand the waiter's shock just looking at that much. It became even easier with the robe open and his entire front reflected in the mirror. Every rib stood out clearly. His collarbones were exquisitely defined ridges covered with skin. His cheekbones bulged. His sternum was a congested knot, his belly a hollow, his pelvis a gruesome hinged wishbone. His legs were, much as he remembered them, long and still quite well muscled, the bones still buried. He never put on much weight there anyway. But above the waist, he really was turning into a carny freak. The human skeleton. 100 pounds, he thought. That's all it takes to bring the hidden ivory man out of the closet. Now you know what a thin edge there is between what you always took for granted and somehow thought would always be, and this utter madness. If you ever wondered, now you know. You still look normal, well, fairly normal with your clothes on. But how long will it be before you start getting looks like the one the waiter gave you even when you're dressed? Next week? The week after? His headache was worse, and although he had been ravenous earlier, he found he could only pick at his dinner. He slept badly and rose early. He did not whistle as he dressed. He decided Kirk Pensley and the investigators from Barton were right. The gypsies would stick to the seacoast. During the summer in Maine, that was where the action was, because that was where the tourists were. They came to swim in water that was too cold, to sun themselves. Many days remained foggy and drizzly, but the tourists never seemed to remember them. To eat lobsters and clams, to buy ashtrays with seagulls painted on them, to attend the summer theaters in Ogunquit and Brunswick, to photograph the lighthouses at Portland and Pemaquid, or just to hang out in trendy places like Rockport, Camden, and, of course, Bar Harbor. The tourists were along the seacoast, and so were the dollars they were so anxious to roll out of their wallets. That's where the gypsies would be. But where, exactly? Billy listed better than 50 seacoast towns and then went downstairs. The bartender was an import from New Jersey who knew from nothing but Asbury Park, but Billy found her waitress who had lived in Maine all her life, was familiar with the seacoast, and loved to talk about it. "I'm looking for some people, and I'm fairly sure they'll be in a seacoast town, but not a really ritzy one, more of a honky-tonk kind of town," she asked. Billy nodded. She bent over his list. "Old Orchard Beach," she said. "That's the honkiest honky-tonk of them all. The way things are down there until Labor Day, your friends wouldn't get noticed unless they had 3 heads each.
"Other ones?"
"Well, most of the seacoast towns get a little honky-tonk in the summer," she said. "Take Bar Harbor, for instance. Everybody who's ever heard of it has an image of Bar Harbor as real ritzy, dignified, full of rich people who go around in Rolls Royces."
"It's not like that?"
"No. Frenchman's Bay, maybe, but not Bar Harbor. In the winter, it's just this dead little town where the 1025 ferry is the most exciting thing to happen all day. In the summer, Bar Harbor's a crazy town. It's like Fort Lauderdale is during spring break, full of heads and freaks and superannuated hippies. You can stand over the town line in Northeast Harbor, take a deep breath, and get stoned from all the dope in Bar Harbor if the wind's right. And the main drag, until after Labor Day, it's a street carnival. Most of these towns you got on your list are like that, mister, but Bar Harbor's like top end, you know."
"I hear you," Billy said, smiling. I used to go up there sometimes in July, August, and hang out, but not anymore. I'm too old for that now.
Billy's smile became wistful. The waitress looked all of 23. Billy gave her $5. She wished him a pleasant summer and good luck finding his friends. Billy nodded, but for the first time he did not feel so sanguine about the possibility.
"You mind a little piece of advice, mister?"
"Not at all," Billy answered, thinking she meant to give him her idea on the best place to start, and that much he had already decided for himself.
"You ought to fatten yourself up a little," she said. "Eat pasta. That's what my mom would tell you. Eat lots of pasta. Put on a few pounds."
A manila envelope full of photographs and automobile information arrived for Halleck on his third day in South Portland. He shuffled through the photographs slowly, looking at each. Here was the young man who had been juggling the pins. His name was also Lemke, Samuel Lemke. He was looking at the camera with an uncompromising openness that looked as ready for pleasure and friendship as it did anger and sullenness. Here was the pretty young girl who had been setting up the slingshot target shoot when the cops landed. And yes, she was every bit as lovely as Halleck had surmised from his side of the common. Her name was Angelina Lemke. He put her picture next to the picture of Samuel Lemke. Brother and sister. The grandchildren of Susanna Lemke, he wondered. The great-grandchildren of Tadeusz Lemke. Here was the elderly man who had been handing out flyers, Richard Crosskill. Other Crosskills were named. Stanchfields, Starbirds, more Lemkes, and then, near the bottom, it was him. The eyes, caught in twin nets of wrinkles, were dark and level and filled with clear intelligence. A kerchief was drawn over his head and knotted beside the left cheek. A cigarette was tucked into the deeply cracked lips. The nose was a wet and open horror, festering and terrible. Billy stared at the picture as if hypnotized. There was something almost familiar about the old man, some connection his mind wasn't quite making. Then it came to him. Tadeusz Lemke reminded him of those old men in the Danon yogurt commercials, the ones from Russian Georgia who smoked unfiltered cigarettes, drank popskull vodka, and lived to such staggering ages as 130, 150, 170. And then a line of a Jerry Jeff Walker song occurred to him, the one about Mr. Bojangles. "He looked at me to be the eyes of age." Yes. That's what he saw in the face of Tadeusz Lemke. He was the very eyes of age. In those eyes, Billy saw a deep knowledge that made all the 20th century a shadow, and he trembled. That night, when he stepped on the scales in the bathroom adjoining his wedge-shaped bedroom, he was down to 137. "Old Orchard Beach," the waitress had said. "That's the honkiest honky-tonk of them all." The desk clerk agreed. So did the girl in the tourist information booth 4 miles down the highway, although she refused to put it in such blatantly pejorative terms. Billy turned his rental car toward Old Orchard Beach, which was about 18 miles south. Traffic slowed to a bumper-to-bumper crawl still a mile from the beach. Most of the vehicles in this parade bore Canadian license plates. A lot of them were thyroidal recvees, which looked big enough to transport entire football teams. Most of the people Billy saw, both in the crawling traffic and walking along the sides of the road, seemed dressed in the least the law would allow and sometimes less. There were a lot of string bikinis, a lot of ball-hugger swim trunks, a lot of oiled flesh on display. Billy was dressed in blue jeans, an open-collared white shirt, and a sport coat. He sat behind the wheel of his car and sweltered, even with the air conditioning on full. But he hadn't forgotten the way the room service kid had looked at him. This was as undressed as he was going to get, even if he finished the day with his sneakers full of sweat puddles. The crawling traffic crossed salt marshes, past 2 dozen lobster and clam shacks, and then wound through an area of summer houses that were crammed together hip to hip and shoulder to shoulder. Similarly undressed people sat on lawn furniture before most of these houses, eating, reading paperback novels, or simply watching the endless flow of traffic. Christ, Billy thought, how do they stand the stink of the exhaust? It occurred to him that perhaps they liked it, that perhaps that was why they were sitting here instead of on the beach, that it reminded them of home. Houses gave way to motels with signs reading En Paul Francais Ici and Canadian Currency at par after 250, and we feature Midnight Blue on cable, and 3 minutes to Ocean, Bonjour en nos amis de la belle Provence. The motels gave way to a main drag, which seemed to feature mostly cut-rate camera stores, souvenir shops, the dirty book emporiums. Kids in cutoffs and tank tops idled up and down, some holding hands, some staring into dirty windows with a blank lack of interest, some riding on skateboards and weaving their way through knots of pedestrians with bored elan. To Billy Halleck's fascinated, dismayed eyes, everyone seemed overweight, and everyone, even the skateboard kids, seemed to be eating something. A slice of pizza here, a chipwich there, a bag of Doritos, a bag of popcorn, a cone of cotton candy. He saw a fat man in an untucked white shirt, baggy green Bermudas, and thong sandals gobbling a foot-long dog. A string of something that was either onion or sauerkraut hung from his chin. He held 2 more dogs between the pudgy fingers of his left hand, and to Billy, he looked like a stage magician displaying red rubber balls before making them disappear. The midway came next. A roller coaster loomed against the sky. A giant replica of a Viking boat swung back and forth in steepening semicircles while the riders strapped inside shrieked. Bells bonged and lights flashed in an arcade to Billy's left. To his right, teenagers in striped muscle shirts drove Dodge-em cars into each other. Just beyond the arcade, a young man and a young woman were kissing. Her arms were locked around his neck. One of his hands cupped her buttocks. The other held a can of Budweiser. Yeah, Billy thought. Yeah, this is the place. Got to be. He parked his car in a baking macadam lot, paid the attendant $17 for a half-day stub, transferred his wallet from his hip pocket to the inside pocket of his sport coat, and started hunting. At first he thought that the weight loss had perhaps speeded up. Everyone was looking at him. The rational part of his mind quickly assured him that it was just because of his clothes, not the way he looked inside his clothes. People would stare at you the same way if you showed up on this boardwalk wearing a swimsuit and a T-shirt in October, Billy. Take it easy. You're just something to look at, and down here there's plenty to look at. And that was certainly true. Billy saw a fat woman in a black bikini, her deeply tanned skin gleaming with oil. Her gut was prodigious, the flex of the long muscles in her thighs nearly mythic and strangely exciting. She moved toward the wide sweep of white beach like an ocean liner, her buttocks flexing in wave-like undulations. He saw a grotesquely fat poodle dog, its curls summer-sheared, its tongue more gray than pink, hanging out listlessly, sitting in the shade of a pizza shack. He saw 2 fistfights. He saw a huge gull with mottled gray wings and dead black eyes swoop down and snatch a greasy doughboy from the hand of an infant in a stroller. Beyond all this was the bone-white crescent of Old Orchard Beach, its whiteness now almost completely obscured by reclining sunbathers at just past noon on an early summer day. But both the beach and the Atlantic beyond it seemed somehow reduced and cheapened by the erotic pulses and pauses of the midway, its snarls of people with food drying on their hands and lips and cheeks, the cry of the hucksters, "Guess your weight," Billy heard from somewhere to his left. "If I miss by more than 5 pounds, you win the dolly of choice." The thin screeches from the rides, the raucous rock music spilling out of the bars. Billy suddenly began to feel decidedly unreal, outside of himself, as if he were having one of those Fate magazine instances of astral projection. Names.
Heidi, Penchley, Linda, Houston seemed suddenly to ring false in tinny, like names made up on the spur of the moment for a bad story. He had a feeling that he could look behind things and see the lights, the cameras, the key grips, and some unimaginable real world. The smell of the sea seemed overwhelmed by a smell of rotten food and salt. Sounds became distant, as if floating down a very long hallway. "Astral projection, my ass," a dim voice pronounced. "You're getting ready to have sunstroke, my friend." "That's ridiculous. I never had a sunstroke in my life." "Well, I guess when you lose 120 pounds, it really fucks up your thermostat. Now, are you going to get out of the sun, or are you going to wind up in an emergency room somewhere giving your Blue Cross and Blue Shield number?" "Okay, you talked me into it," Billy mumbled. And the kid who was passing by and dumping a box of Reese's Pieces into his mouth turned and gave him a sharp look. There was a bar up ahead called the Seven Seas. There were two signs taped to the door. "Icy Cool" read one. "Terminal Happy Hour" read the other. Billy went in. The Seven Seas was not only icy cool, it was blessedly quiet. A sign on the juke read, "Some asshole kicked me last night, and now I am out of order." Below this was a French translation of the same sentiment. But Billy thought from the aged look of the sign and the dust on the juke that the last night in question might have been a good many years ago. There were a few patrons in the bar, mostly older men who were dressed much as Billy himself was dressed, as if for the street rather than the beach. Some were playing checkers and backgammon. Almost all were wearing hats. "Help you?" the bartender asked, coming over.
"I'd like a schooner, please."
"Okay."
The beer came. Billy drank it slowly, watching the boardwalk ebb and flow outside the windows of the bar, listening to the murmur of the old men. He felt some of his strength, some of his sense of reality, begin to come back. The bartender returned.
"Hit you again?"
"Please, and I'd like a word with you if you have time."
"About what?"
"Some people who might have been through here."
"Where's here, the seas?"
"Old Orchard." The bartender laughed.
"So far as I can see, everyone in Maine and half of Canada comes through here in the summer, old son."
These were gypsies. The bartender grunted and brought Billy a fresh bottle of schooner.
"You mean they were drift trade? Everyone who comes to Old Orchard in the summer is. The place here is a little different. Most of the guys who come in here live here year-round. The people out there..." He waved at the window, dismissing them with a flick of the wrist. "Drift trade. Like you, mister."
Billy poured the schooner carefully down the side of his glass and then laid a $10 bill on the bar. "I'm not sure we understand each other. I'm talking about real, actual gypsies, not tourists or summer people."
"Real? Oh, you must mean those guys who are camped out by the salt shack."
Billy's heart speeded in his chest. "Can I show you some pictures?"
"Wouldn't do you any good. I didn't see them."
He looked at the 10 for a moment and then called.
"Lon, Lonnie, come over here a minute."
One of the old men who had been sitting by the window got up and shuffled over to the bar. He was wearing gray cotton pants, a white shirt that was too big for him, and a snap-brimmed straw hat. His face was weary. Only his eyes were alive. He reminded Billy of someone, and after a few moments it came to him. The old man looked like Lee Strasberg, the teacher and actor.
"This is Lon Enders," the bartender said. "He's got a little place just on the west of town. Same side the salt shack's on. Lon sees everything that goes on in Old Orchard."
"I'm Bill Halleck."
"Meet you,"
Lon Enders said in a papery voice and took the stool next to Billy's. He did not really seem to sit. Rather, his knees appeared to buckle the moment his buttocks were poised over the cushion. "Would you like a beer?" Billy asked.
"Can't,"
the papery voice rustled, and Billy moved his head slightly to avoid the oversweet smell of Ender's breath.
"Already had my one for the day. Doctor says no more than that. Guts are screwed up. If I was a car, I'd be ready for the scrap heap."
"Oh," Billy said lamely. The bartender turned away from them and began loading beer glasses into a dishwasher. Ender's looked at the $10 bill. Then he looked at Billy. Halleck explained again while Ender's tired, too shiny face looked dreamily off into the shadows of the seven seas and the arcade bells bonged faintly like sounds overheard in a dream next door.
"They was here," he said when Billy had finished. "They was here, all right. I hadn't seen any gypsies in 7 years or more. Hadn't seen this bunch in maybe 20 years.
Billy's right hand squeezed the beer glass he was holding, and he had to consciously make himself relax his grip before he broke it. He set the glass down carefully on the bar. "When? Are you sure? Do you have any idea where they might have been going? Can you—" Enders held up one hand. It was as white as the hand of a drowned man pulled from a well, and to Billy it seemed dimly transparent.
"Easy, my friend," he said in his whispering voice. "I'll tell you what I know."
With the same conscious effort, Billy forced himself to say nothing, to just wait.
"I'll take the 10 spot because you look like you can afford it, my friend," Enders whispered.
He tucked it into his shirt pocket and then pushed the thumb and forefinger of his left hand into his mouth, adjusting his upper plate.
"But I'd talk for free. Hell, when you get old, you find out you'd pay someone to listen. Ask Timmy there if I can have a glass of cold water, would you? Even the one beer's too much, I reckon. It's burning what's left of my stomach something fierce. But it's hard for a man to give up all his pleasures, even when they don't pleasure him no more."
Billy called the bartender over, and he brought Enders his ice water. "You okay, Lon?" he asked as he put it down.
"I've been better and I've been worse,"
Lon whispered, and picked up the glass. For a moment, Billy thought it was going to prove too heavy. But the old man got it to his mouth, although some spilled on the way there.
"You want to talk to this guy?"
Timmy asked. The cold water seemed to revive Enders. He put the glass down, looked at Billy, looked back at the bartender.
"I think somebody ought to," he said. "He don't look as bad as me yet, but he's getting there."
Enders lived in a small retirees colony on Cove Road. He said Cove Road was part of the real old orchard, the one the tips don't care about. "Tips?" Billy asked.
"The crowds, my friend, the crowds. Me and the wife came to this town in 1946, just after the war. Been here ever since. I learned how to turn a tip from a master, Lonesome Tommy McGee, dead these many years now. Yelled my guts out, I did, and what you hear now is all that's left."
The chuckle, almost as faint as a breath of pre-dawn breeze, came again. Enders had known everyone associated with the summer carnival that was Old Orchard, it seemed. The vendors, the pitchmen, the roustabouts, the glass-chuckers, souvenir salesmen, the dogsmen, ride mechanics, the bumpers, the carnies, the pumps, and the pimps. Most of them were year-round people he had known for decades, or people who returned each summer like migratory birds. They formed a stable, mostly loving community that the summer people never saw. He also knew a large portion of what the bartender had called drift trade. These were the true transients, people who showed up for a week or 2 weeks, did some business in the feverish party town atmosphere of Old Orchard, and then moved on again. "And you remember them all?" Billy asked doubtfully.
"Oh, I wouldn't if they was all different from year to year," Enders whispered. "But that's not how drift trade is. They ain't as regular as the dogsmen and the dough-thumpers, but they have a pattern, too. You see this fella who comes on the boardwalk in 1957 selling hula hoofs off of his arm? You see him again in 1960 selling expensive watches for $3 apiece. His hair's maybe black instead of blonde, and so he thinks people don't recognize him, and I guess the summer people don't, even if they was around in 1957, because they go right back and get rooked again. But we know 'em. We know the drift trade. Nothing changes but what they sell, and what they sell is always a few steps outside the law. The pushers, they're different. There's too many, and they are always going to jail or dying off. And the whores get old too fast to want to remember. But you wanted to talk about gypsies. I guess they're the oldest drift trade of all, when you stop to think about it."
Billy took his envelope of photographs from his sport coat pocket and laid them out carefully like a pat poker hand. Gina Lemke, Samuel Lemke, Richard Crosskill, Mora Starbird. Tadus Lemka.
Ah!
The old man on the stool breathed in sharply when Billy put that last one down, and then he spoke directly to the photograph, cooling Billy's skin.
Teddy, you old whoremaster.
He looked up at Billy and smiled, but Billy Halleck was not fooled. The old man was afraid.
I thought it was him, he said. I didn't see nothing but a shape in the dark. This was 3 weeks ago. Nothing but a shape in the dark, but I thought, no, I knew.
He fumbled the ice water to his mouth again, spilling more this time down the front of his shirt. The cold made him gasp. The bartender came over and favored Billy with a hostile glance. Enders held his hand up absently to show he was all right. Timmy retreated to the dishwasher again. Enders turned the photograph of Tadus Lemka over. Written on the back was, "Photo taken, Attleboro, Mass., mid-May, 1983.
And he hasn't aged a day since I first seen him and his friends here in the summer of 1963,
Enders finished. They had set up camp behind Herc's Salt Shack Lobster Barn on Route 27. They had stayed 4 days and four nights. On the fifth morning, they were simply gone. Cove Road lay close by, and Enders said he had walked the half mile the second evening the gypsies were there. It was hard for Billy to imagine this ghostly man walking around the block, but he let it pass. He wanted to see them, he said, because they reminded him of the old days, when a man could run his business if he had a business to run, and John Law stayed out of his way and let him do it.
I stood there by the side of the road quiet a while, he said. It was the usual rarity and gypsy turnout. The more things change, the more they stay the same. It used to be all tents, and now it's vans and campers and such, but what goes on inside, it's just the same. A woman telling fortunes, 2-3 women selling powders to the ladies, 2-3 men selling powders to the men. I guess they would have stayed longer, but I heard they arranged a dogfight for some rich Canucks, and the state cops got wind of it.
Dogfight?
People want to bet, my friend, and the drift trade is always willing to arrange the things they want to bet on. That's one of the things drift trade is for. Dogs or roosters with steel spurs, or maybe even two men with these itty-bitty sharp knives that look almost like spikes, and each of them bites the end of a scarf, and the one who drops his end first is the loser. What the gypsies call a fair one.
Enders was staring at himself in the back bar mirror, at himself and through himself.
It was like the old days, all right, he said dreamily. I could smell their meat, the way they cure it, and green peppers, and that olive oil they like that smells rancid when it comes out of the can and then sweet when it's being cooked. I could hear them talking their funny language and this thud, thud, thud that was someone throwing knives at a board. Someone was cooking bread the old way on hot stones. It was like old times, but I wasn't. I felt scared. Well, the gypsies always scared me a little. Difference was, back then, I would have gone in anyway. Hell, I was a white man, wasn't I? In the old days, I would have walked right up to the fire just as big as Billy be damned and bought a drink or maybe a few joysticks. Not just because I wanted a drink or a toke, but just in order to get a look around. But the old days made me an old man, my friend. And when an old man is scared, he don't just go on regardless like he did when he was just learning to shave. So I just stood there in the dark with the salt shack over on my one side and all those vans and campers and station wagons pulled up over here on my other, watching them walk back and forth in front of their fire, listening to them talk and laugh, smelling their food. And then the back of this one camper opened. It had a picture of a woman on the side, and a white horse with a horn sticking out of its head. What do you call it?
Unicorn, Billy said, and his voice seemed to come from somewhere or someone else. He knew that camper very well. he had first seen it on the day the gypsies came to the Fairview Town Common.
"Then someone got out," Anders went on. "Just a shadow and a red cigarette tip, but I knew who it was."
He tapped the photograph of the man in the kerchief with one pale finger.
"Him. Your pal."
"You're sure?"
"He took a big drag on his butt, and I saw that."
He pointed at what was left of Tadus Lemke's nose, but did not quite touch the glossy surface of the photograph, as if touch might be to risk contamination. "Did you speak to him?"
"No," Anders said, "but he spoke to me. I stood there in the dark, and I swear to God he wasn't even looking in my direction. And he said, 'You miss your wife some, Flash, huh? It's be all right. You be with her soon now.' Then he flicked his cigarette off the end of his fingers and walked away toward the fire. I seen the hoop in his ear flash once in the firelight, and that was all."
He wiped little beads of water from his chin with the cup of his hand and looked at Billy.
"Flash was what they used to call me when I worked the penny pitch on the pier back in the 50s, my friend. But nobody had called me that for years. I was way back in the shadows, but he saw me, and he called me by my old name, what the gypsies would call my secret name, I guess. They set a hell of a star by knowing a man's secret name."
"Do they?" Billy asked, almost to himself. Timmy, the bartender, came over again. This time he spoke to Billy almost kindly, as though Lon Enders was not there.
"He on the 10, buddy. Leave him alone. He ain't well. And this here little discussion ain't making him no weller."
"I'm okay, Timmy," Enders said.
Timmy didn't look at him. He looked at Billy Halleck instead.
"I want you to get out of here," he said to Billy in that same reasonable, almost kind voice. "I don't like your looks. You look like bad luck waiting for a place to happen. The beers are free. Just go."
Billy looked at the bartender, feeling frightened and somehow humbled. "Okay," he said. "Just one more question and I'll go." He turned to Enders. "Where did they head for?"
"I don't know," Enders said at once. "Gypsies don't leave forwarding addresses, my friend."
Billy's shoulders slumped.
"But I was up when they pulled out the next morning. I don't sleep worth a shit anymore, and most of the vans and cars didn't have much in the way of mufflers. I seen them go out Highway 27 and turn north onto Route 1. My guess would be Rockland."
The old man fetched in a deep, shuddering sigh that made Billy lean toward him, concerned.
"Rockland, or maybe Booth Bay Harbor. Yes, that's all I know, my friend, except that when he called me Flash, when he called me by my secret name, I pissed all the way down my leg into my left tennis shoe."
And Lon Enders abruptly began to cry.
"Mister, would you leave?" Timmy asked.
"I'm going," Billy said, and did, pausing only to squeeze the old man's narrow, almost ethereal shoulder. Outside, the sun hit him like a hammer. It was mid-afternoon now, the sun heeling over toward the west, and when he looked to his left, he saw his own shadow, as scrawny as a child's stick figure, poured on the hot white sand like ink. He dialed area code 203. They set a hell of a store by knowing a man's secret name. He dialed 555. "I want you to get out of here. I don't like your looks." He dialed 9231 and listened to the phone begin to ring back home in Fat City. "You look like bad luck waiting..." "Hello?" The voice, expectant and a little breathless, was not Heidi's, but Linda's. Lying on his bed in his wedge-shaped hotel room, Billy closed his eyes against the sudden sting of tears. He saw her as she had been on the night he had walked her up Lantern Drive and talked to her about the accident, her old shorts, her long, coltish legs. "What are you going to say to her, Billy boy? That you spent the day at the beach sweating out moisture, that lunch was two beers, and that in spite of a big supper which featured not one but two sirloin steaks, you lost 3 pounds today instead of the usual 2? "Hello?" "That you're bad luck waiting for a place to happen? That you're sorry you lied, but all parents do it?" "Hello, is anyone there? Is that you, Bobby?"
Eyes still closed, he said. "It's Dad, Linda."
"Daddy?"
"Honey, I can't talk," he said, "because I'm almost crying. I'm still losing weight, but I think I found Lemke's trail. Tell your mother that. I think I found Lemke's trail. Will you remember?"
"Daddy, please come home."
She was crying. Billy's hand whitened on the telephone.
"I miss you, and I'm not going to let her send me away anymore."
Dimly, he could hear Heidi now.
"Lynn, is it Dad?"
"I love you, doll," he said. "And I love your mother."
"Daddy!"
A confusion of small sounds. Then Heidi was on the phone.
"Billy? Billy, please stop this and come home to us."
Billy gently hung the phone up and rolled over on the bed and put his face into his crossed arms.
He checked out of the South Portland Sheraton the next morning and headed north on U.S. 1, the long coastal highway which begins in Fort Kent, Maine, and ends in Key West, Florida. Rockland or maybe Booth Bay Harbor, the old man in the Seven Seas had said, but Billy took no chances. He stopped at every second or third gas station on the northbound side of the road. He stopped at general stores where old men sat out front in lawn chairs, chewing toothpicks or wooden matches. He showed his pictures to everyone who would look. He swapped two $100 traveler's checks for $2 bills and passed them out like a man promoting a radio show with dubious ratings. The four photographs he showed most frequently were the girl, Gina, with her clear olive skin and her dark promising eyes, the converted Cadillac hearse, the VW microbus with the girl and the unicorn painted on the side, Tadus Lemke. Like Lon Enders, people didn't want to handle that one, or even touch it. But they were helpful, and Billy Halleck had no trouble at all following the gypsies up the coast. It wasn't the out-of-state plates. There were lots of out-of-state plates to be seen in Maine during the summer. It was the way the cars and vans traveled together, almost bumper to bumper, the colorful pictures on the sides, the gypsies themselves. Most of the people Billy talked to claimed that the women or children had stolen things, but all seemed vague on just what had been stolen. And no one, so far as Billy could ascertain, had called the cops because of these supposed thefts. Mostly they remembered the old gypsy with the rotting nose. If they had seen him, they remembered him most of all. Sitting in the Seven Seas with Lon Enders, he'd been 3 weeks behind the gypsies. The owner of Bob's Speedy Serve station wasn't able to remember the day he had filled up their cars and trucks and vans, one after another, only that they stunk like engines. Billy thought that Bob smelled pretty ripe himself, but decided that saying so might be rather imprudent. The college kid working at the Falmouth Beverage Barn across the road from the Speedy Serve was able to peg the day exactly. It had been June 2nd, his birthday, and he had been unhappy about working. The day Billy spoke to them was June 20th, and he was 18 days behind. The gypsies had tried to find a camping place a little farther north in the Brunswick area and had been moved along. On June 4th, they had camped in Booth Bay Harbor. Not on the seacoast itself, of course, but they had found a farmer willing to rent them a hayfield in the Keniston Hill area for $20 a night. They had stayed only 3 days in the area. The summer season was still only getting underway, and pickings had apparently been slim. The farmer's name was Washburn. When Billy showed him the picture of Tadus Lemke, he nodded and blessed himself, quickly, and Billy was convinced of this unconsciously.
"I never seen an old man move as fast as that one did, and I seen him lugging more wood stacked up than my sons could carry."
Washburn hesitated and added, I didn't like him. It wasn't just his nose. Hell, my own gramps had skin cancer, and before it carried him off, it had rotted a hole in his cheek the size of an ashtray. You could look right in there and see him chewing his food. Well, we didn't like that, but we still liked Grandpa, if you see what I mean. Billy nodded. But this guy, I didn't like him. I thought he looked like a bugger. Billy thought to ask for a translation of that particular New Englandism, and then decided he didn't need one. Bugger, bugbear, boogeyman. The translation was in Farmer Washburn's eyes. He is a bugger, Billy said, with great sincerity. I had made up my mind to send him down the road, he told Billy. $20 a night just for cleaning up some litter is a good piece of wages, but the wife was scared of them, and I was a little bit scared of them, too. So I went out there morning to give that Lemke guy the news before I could lose my nerve, and I was already on the roll. Relieved me quite a bit. They headed north again. They sure did. I stood right on top of the hill there, he pointed, and watched them turn onto US-1. I watched them until they was out of sight, and I was some glad to see them go.
Yes, I'll bet you were.
Washburn cast a critical, rather worried eye on Billy.
You want to come up to the house and have a glass of cold buttermilk, mister? You look peaked.
Thank you, but I want to get up around the Owl's Head area before sundown if I can.
Looking for him?
Yes.
Well, if he find him, I hope he don't eat you up, mister, because he looked hungry to me.
Billy spoke to Washburn on the 21st, the first day of official summer, although the roads were already choked with tourists, and he had to go all the way inland to Sheepscot before he was able to find a motel with a vacancy sign, and the gypsies had rolled out of Booth Bay Harbor on the morning of the 8th. 13 days behind now. He had had a bad 2 days then when it seemed like the gypsies had fallen off the edge of the world. They had not been seen in Owl's Head nor in Rockland, although both of them were prime summer tourist towns. Gas station attendants and waitresses looked at his pictures and shook their heads. Grimly battling an urge to vomit precious calories over the rail, he had never been much of a sailor. Billy rode the inter-island ferry from Owl's Head to Vinylhaven, but the gypsies had not been there either. On the evening of the 23rd, he called Kirk Pinchley, hoping for fresh information. And when Kirk came on the line, there was a funny double click just at the moment Kirk asked, "How are you, Billy boy? And where are you?" Billy hung up quickly, sweating. He had snagged the final unit in Rockland's Harborview Motel. He knew there probably wasn't another motel unit to be had between here and Bangor, and he suddenly decided he was going to move on, even if it meant he ended up spending the night sleeping in the car on some pasture road. That double click. He hadn't cared for that double click at all. You sometimes heard that sound when the wire was being tapped, or when traceback equipment was being used.
Heidi signed the papers on you, Billy.
That's the stupidest goddamn thing I ever heard.
She signed them and Houston co-signed them.
Give me a fucking break.
Get out of here, Billy.
He left. Heidi, Houston, and the possible traceback equipment aside, it turned out to be the best thing that he could have done. As he was checking into the Bangor Ramada Inn that morning at 2 o'clock, he showed the desk clerk the pictures. It had become a habit by now, and the clerk nodded at once.
Yeah, I took my girl over and got her fortune read, he said.
He picked up the photograph of Gina Lemke and rolled his eyes.
She could really work it on out with that slingshot of hers, and she looked like she could work it on out in a few other ways, if you know what I mean.
He shook his hand as if flicking water from the tips of his fingers.
My girl got one look at the way I was looking at her, and she dragged me out of there fast.
He laughed. A moment before, Billy had been so tired that bed was all he could think about. Now he was wide awake again, his stomach cramping with adrenaline. Where? Where were they? Or are they still...
Nah, they're not there anymore. Parsons is where they were, but they're gone all right. I was by there the other day.
Is it a farmer's place?
No, it's where Parsons' bargain barn used to be until it burned down last year.
He cast an uneasy eye at the way Billy's sweatshirt bagged on his body, at the blades of Billy's cheekbones and the skull-like contours of Billy's face, in which the eyes burned like candle flames.
You want to check in?
Billy found Parsons' bargain barn the following morning. It was a scorched, cinder-block shell in the middle of what seemed to be 9 acres of deserted parking lot. He walked slowly across the crumbling macadam, heels clicking. Here were beer cans and soda cans. Here was a rind of cheese with beetles crawling in it. Here was a single shiny ball bearing. "Hoi, Gina," a ghostly voice called in his head. Here were the dead skins of popped balloons, and here was the dead skins of 2 used Trojans, so similar to the balloons. Yes, they had been here. "I smell you, old man," Billy whispered to the empty hull of the bargain barn, and the empty spaces that had been windows seemed to stare back at the scrawny scarecrow man with sallow distaste. The place looked haunted, but Billy felt no fear. The anger was back on him. He wore it like a coat. Anger at Heidi, anger at Tadus Lemke, anger at so-called friends like Kirk Pinchley, who were supposed to be on his side, but who had turned against him. Had or would. It didn't matter. Even on his own, even at 130 pounds, there was enough of him left to catch up to the old gypsy man. And what would happen then? Well, they would see, wouldn't they? "I smell you, old man," Billy said again, and walked up to the side of the building. There was a realtor sign there. Billy took his notebook from his back pocket and jotted down the information on it. The realtor's name was Frank Quigley, but he insisted that Billy call him Biff. There were framed pictures of a high school-age Biff Quigley on the walls. In most of them, Biff was wearing a football helmet. On Biff's desk was a pile of bronzed dog turds. "Frenchman's driver's license," the little sign beneath read. Yes, Biff said, he had rented the place to the old gyp with Mr. Parsons' approval. "He figured it couldn't look any worse than it does right now," Biff Quigley said, "and I guess he was right at that." He leaned back in his swivel chair, his eyes crawling ceaselessly over Billy's face, measuring the gap between Billy's collar and Billy's neck, the way the front of Billy's shirt hung in folds like a flag on a still day. He laced his hands behind his head, rocked back in his office chair, and put his feet up on his desk beside the bronzed turds. "Not that it isn't priced to sell, you understand. That's prime industrial land out there, and sooner or later someone with some vision is going to make himself one hell of a deal. Yes, sir, one hell of a—" "When did the gypsies leave, Biff?" Biff Quigley removed his hands from behind his head and sat forward. His chair made a noise like a mechanical pig. "Squink! Mind telling me why you want to know?" Billy Halleck's lip